Man, I've been dying to talk to you.
Well, what took you so long?
I don't know how to get a hold of you. You know what's weird? Do you live in L.A.?
No, I do not live in L.A. Do you?
I do, but you used to live in L.A., right?
Oh, yeah, I did 20 years in L.A. I did.
Yeah, and I always thought, well, I'll run into him one day. But you're a lot like Alex Van Halen. I never saw you out ever.
Well, it would have been in the earlier years, I guess. I would, you know, as Ron Blair used to call it, the accessible years.
Oh, yeah. Where are you at now?
I'm currently in St. Augustine, Florida.
Wow. You live in Florida?
I do. I grew up here. So this is where my roots were. So at the end of the tenure with the band, I already had sort of started moving back here, but it was a real natural progression. You know, my family was still here and I had friends here. And so when my life changed and my second act showed up, it was just more fun to do it from Florida. It was easy for me. It was fun, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a comedian and I tour with Bill Burr. I believe you got him a kit in New Orleans. He said to say thank you.
Oh man, how cool is, how did you do in LA? Are you okay? Are you all right?
Yeah. Yeah. You mean the fires?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, it was, not too far from me, but mostly it was all about that, the aftermath of the air, you know?
I bet.
Yeah. Just like really brutal out there. My lungs were just trashed, but you know, it's tragic what's going on out there. I mean, you know, how are they going to rebuild all that? It's going to take years.
I think it'll be a generational thing. I really do. And, but I also want to mention, hey, I just heard Burr on
Fresh Air.
Yeah. Great. Oh man. He had me on the edge of my seat the whole time. What a dude. What a dude. Please pass on the respect and admiration. And, you know, I think, you know, been a big fan of his for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. He was pretty excited. Like I was, you know, I said, hey, I'm going to interview Stan. He's in New York getting ready to do Glengarry Glen Ross. Tonight's the opening night. Yeah. And he's like, oh, Stan, tell him. I think he got me a drum kit in New Orleans. Tell him. Thank you.
I'd be glad to get him another one.
You know, I first heard you, of course, kick, snare, breakdown. You know, that's when I first become a Tom Petty fan. It comes out of the radio there in the Bay Area where I grew up, you know, and I was like, oh, I got to have that. And immediately went and bought the record and I've been a fan of yours ever since. To me, you're a lot like, and people, since I played music 25 years, they don't understand. You're a lot like a Phil Rudd or even a Steven Adler in the sense of once that drummer's out, it's a different feel. Sure, the songs are what it's about, you know, at the end of the day, but the feel. And I always thought you and Benmont were just this secret sauce of the Heartbreakers.
All I can say is thank you. I don't think there's a question in there, but thank you very much. It's very kind. That's very generous praise. You know, all Phil Rudd, you know, the joke is he plays like his name sounds, Phil Rudd. You know, it's so good. His sound is, you know, those records. In terms of replaceability of musicians, things change, you know, like they're not supposed to stay the same. I mean, that's a very romantic notion when a band does stay the same forever. My tenure with the band, I was so proud of the 20 I did. And I'm so grateful that I didn't do the last 20 because I would have been the wrong guy. They were looking for a different sound. They were looking for a different feel. And they were very happy with what they accomplished. And I was very proud of them. It just wasn't my strength and it wasn't my passion and my life had moved in another direction. But I remain extremely proud of the work that I got to do with the Heartbreakers and Tom. I thought it was It was cool shit. I was happy with it.
Oh my God. I mean, it's mind-boggling. I mean, being back there behind the kit, you got to just be like laughing. It's like the Cars. I say no piss tracks when you go to the concert. Every song is just this iconic FM smasher, you know?
Well, we were very fortunate to have early on, we all knew that Tom brought an extra chromosome to the table. He brought something. He was a storyteller. He was gifted at remembering lyrics. He was gifted at writing them. And that's where the rubber meets the road, is in the storytelling. And, you know, sure, grooves are compelling. Chord progressions are compelling. And they're definitely important. But the guy at the microphone is the ultimate cheerleader, and he plants the flag. That's was always my North Star, is having a good singer and a good song. And then, man, we're off to the races, you know?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that's got to be just crazy. You're just in there, like, rehearsing. He's like, hey, I kind of got this one here. And you're just like, what? Now, were you involved on the songwriting back then?
No. I was writing, but we happened to have a really good one. And there was really no, and I wasn't good. You know, I was working toward it. You know, I was something that was, you know, we'd all written in our early bar bands and written originals, but it was incredibly obvious who had the high cards. You know what I mean? When it came to the writing. And, you know, as Mike Campbell used to say, he had a joke. He goes, boy can lay a lip along a lyric. And I loved that when he said that one day. It's like, yes. And it made me very proud when Tom would have those early songs. They spoke, you know, like people walk up to me a lot of times and they say, man, I remember where I was when I heard such and such or this and that. Well, I do too. You know, remember, I do too. I was a little kid in a rock and roll band. I remember the first time I heard American Girl. I remember the first time I heard Refugee and Here Comes My Girl. And, you know, and they spoke for me too. You know, like when, I mean, I was the, you know, the guy going like, what he said.
Yeah.
Like, so I was a huge fan of the Heartbreakers when I just happened to be in them.
God, insane. You know, I played music, like I said, 25 years. And once I heard Tom Petty, that was really the blueprint of my songwriting for years. You know, it's just so crazy to see each guy in the Heartbreakers, you know, you, Howie, Ben Mont, you know, those three to me were always like, wow, man. And Howie and your vocals, you know, that was like such a huge thing. You know, now, you know, back then all the guys sang, you know, like you look at bands, every guy sang, Eagles, Kiss, Beatles, whatever it is, every guy sang, you know, and to see a drummer sing that great was pretty rare, you know?
Well, I was cleaving to someone very stylized.
Yeah.
And, so without knowing it, Tom was teaching me how to phrase and how to pronounce words or mispronounce them, as the case may be, you know? So I had, they were my friends. They were my mentors. They were my brothers. And it was the collective of those group of people was extraordinary. And you mentioned Ben Mont, who was, I was closest, you know, to, and shared the same sense of humor. And we both read the same books and we were, and he still is to this day. I would count him as one of my dearest friends and supremely talented and cool. And, you know, I was a lucky guy, you know, that I was in the room when the lightning hit, you know, it was nice.
Ben Mont is unbelievable. I lived in a small apartment in Hollywood and somehow was lucky enough to get him on the podcast. And it was wild just to see Ben Mont in this Hollywood apartment. Like, I don't know, 5 years ago, he's just on the couch. And, you know, I'm just like, this is goddamn Ben Mont Tench, you know, the keyboard wizard, man. I mean, played on a million records also, you know, unreal.
I have the same reaction when I talk to him. I go, you know, and I tell her, I go like, you know, wow, I got Ben Montench on the phone. You know, he's like, and he likes me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What was it early for you? Was it Ringo? Was that what got you going?
I think it got everybody going. You know, the Ed Sullivan Show was MTV when we were kids. You know, there was one radio station in the town we all grew up in, and it played everything. You know, from it would play, you know, back to back, James Brown, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Frank Sinatra, you know. So music didn't have a genre when we were kids. It was just music. And you grew up marinating in all this incredible music. Yeah. So by the time you were tuning into the TV, you know, and you saw the first rock and roll bands.
Oh, yeah.
It was mind boggling. I mean, you know, would you like when to be a little boy? I mean, I think it was like 8 years old when the Beatles hit, and it just ripped me up. But the band that probably the drummer that really messed me up was Charlie Watts.
Oh, man.
I mean, Ringo was unattainable. He was the whole Beatle thing was unobtainium. You know, when it came out, it was just like, this is not, I don't even know what I'm looking at. My sister was going crazy. Every girl was going crazy. Everybody was going crazy. When the Stones came out, it was more like you had to lean in and go like, these guys are tough. They just seemed, they were just like, even though it turns out the Beatles were just as ornery and just as rough, but the exterior of the Stones drew me in, like, because that's a gang, man. I just wanted to be in that gang. I loved everything about those guys. And Charlie played traditional, you know, I learned how to play. I, you know, so to me, it was total validation, like, you know, like, oh yeah. And then Mick Avery's from the Kinks and all the bands would come out on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I just, people would be telling me how great Paul McCartney was. And all I'd go is like, Ringo, or, you know, the same with Mick Jagger. He's fantastic. Charlie Watts, you know, like every band, I just was like, oh my God, that's the coolest magic trick in the world, you know, to play drums. And it was like a superpower once I learned how to do it. You know, all my inhibitions and fear and, you know, and all the rejection and being worried about being bullied and getting my ass whipped. Once I had a superpower, it was like, you know, okay, I don't know if I'm a good drummer, but I'm better than most of the guys in, you know, in the school today. So you get a reputation early as like, oh yeah, that guy plays drums, you know, so maybe you don't want to whip his ass, you know?
You were a fighter, right? Growing up?
No, I was a loser fighter. I was the guy, I got beat up a lot. You know, it's like, you know, I shot my mouth off and, you know, that never changed. And I might've been borderline Tourette's, you know, because literally my inside voice and my outside voice, I couldn't, you know, I'd go like, oh shit, was that my outside voice? You know, it's like, I was thinking it. And so by the time I'd say something, usually it would be followed immediately by like, or somebody going, meet me at 3 o'clock in the oak tree. You're about to get your ass handed to you. But it was, you know, I don't know. It all worked out. All's well that ends well.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was in San Francisco and I was lucky enough to see the opening of the Paul McCartney photo exhibit.
Oh, how cool.
Oh my God. So he carried a camera on those first like 6 weeks when they play Ed Sullivan and then they do Miami and they do like Chicago, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're looking at this and it is so mind-boggling to me how it'll never, ever be like that again. The organicness, the no cell phones, the new danger of a weird haircut, some weed mixed into that, and just Beatlemania. I mean, at one point, they're showing them come into JFK, and there's thousands of kids on the tarmac. I mean, think about that. You can't even go through the gate now without a ticket. They're out on the tarmac.
Right.
That's wild.
It's so cool watching, seeing Paul take pictures of people taking pictures. And, you know, but his presence, their presence of mind and their relaxed nature is it's Marx Brothers It's so, you know, it's like almost like they were just born cool. Like some of the guys, my heroes, they appear to have just come out of the womb, you know, wearing black leather jackets and knowing how to smoke a cigarette. You know, they had it down, and they were beautiful at it, and they backed it up, man. All those bands that I grew up loving, when they counted four, stand back. I mean, the song's great. The performance is great. The groove is great. The singing is great. The look is, you know, it's like, it's pretty cool to, I think we grew up in a, or I, you know, I don't know how old you are, but
I'm 59. So I grew up in it also. I mean, I'm 10 years behind you, but I definitely was in the thick of rock and roll, you know, growing up in the Bay Area, Bill Graham, just the melting pot of everything from Santana to the Dead to Metallica to, you know, all, you know, different stuff, Primus, whatever. It was just a full pot.
Well, I'm still a fan. I'm a little dinosaur like in what I love. I tend to still love it. I love everything I loved when I was 13. You know, I still love cars and girls and rock and roll, and nothing's really changed. It's like, you know, except me in the mirror, you know, I just go like, who the fuck is that guy? You know, but other than that, it's great. I mean, I feel so fortunate to have been around so long and seen so much. It's great.
Oh yeah. I hear you, man. And, you know, just to think about, like, people are always like, there's no good music anymore. And I walk away from those people, you know, it's like, wow. I mean, there's a guy right now, MJ Lenderman. He's got a record out right now that is just, you know, and it's the same old thing with me. Great songs. You know, it's like, listen to this guy's songs. Wow. You know?
Yeah. If you're not careful, you put on a Get Off My Lawn shirt pretty quick, you know?
Totally.
And you don't want to be that guy. Although there's pieces of me, sometimes I embrace it because there's certain things in the culture I don't want to be part of. So I'm an active decision. I mean, shit, I still carry a flip phone. I don't text. I don't want to text. You know, it's like, I just don't want to. It's like, doesn't mean I can't, but I prefer if somebody just call me. You know, I prefer it. So I have preferences, but I don't have a whole lot of rules.
So an interesting question I always like to ask the drummers, since you weren't involved with the songwriting, there is always that thing of when it comes down to money with a group, you know, either a group will share everything four or five ways or they don't. So how was that constructed?
It worked out great. You know, the specifics, you know, it's an evolution. You know, when as a band is on the way up, things are usually very egalitarian because there's not a lot. And as things progress, you have to become more honest about who is more deserving and who works harder. And probably that was one of the motivations for me to get off my ass and go write and produce. And I was fortunate that I got a second act. So I never really concerned myself. And money, the only time I ever thought about it was when I didn't have it. I mean, it was painful to be broke. And I was feral for a lot of years in LA. I mean, I lived in a basement, you know, I was hitchhiking, you know, I had a stolen motorcycle. And, you know, so it was, I come from a, you know, it's not like I lived under a bridge, but damn near, you know what I mean? And I was the kindness of others was, and still is, but it was really nice back in LA in the 70s too, because this was before there were gates on all the houses. And I remember even walking through Beverly Hills and, I'm trying to remember, who was our man Flint, our man, James Coburn. I was walking down the street and James Coburn, I saw him in a yard. And I obviously knew who he was. He didn't know who I was. I'm just some schmuck with long hair. And I'm looking at his trees and he goes, hey, you need any grapefruit? Like, help yourself. You know, it's like, so that was the world, you know, and he got in a beautiful red Ferrari and and said hello to me. I mean, literally, like, hey, you a musician? Like, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, he goes, oh, you know. So it was like that, the world, it seemed like you were always, you were welcome. It wasn't such an elite party as by the time I left, I felt like, you know, oh man, you got to pay to play the Whiskey a Go-Go.
Yeah.
I mean, shit, when we were, you worked your way up and you played the Whiskey or you played the Starwood or you played the, you know, it wasn't like this elite velvet rope world that I grew up in California. It was still, there was the reverb of the 60s and the, you know, the early 70s. And I loved it. I thrived in that environment because it was very social. You know, you go out and go see a band and you'd be sitting there. And the next thing you know, you're talking to the guys in Cheap Trick who are just getting signed at the Starwood. And, you know, you're talking to, you know, you're talking to Carmine Appice and you're talking to all these guys that are just, and you're learning and you're rubbing up against it. And it wasn't, that's what I think that's been lost a little. And I think it was wonderful to cohabitate creatively in LA in that first 10 years it was great, man. I mean, it was great. Actors, musicians, everybody, stuntmen, you know, you were invited everywhere. You know, it was just, you were all over. Everybody was everywhere.
I'll tell you what's still got that vibe. That is probably the last of the old school would be the Comedy Store. Cause I started comedy at 44. I'm 59 now. And I was blown away and still am blown away nightly how you could be in the Comedy Store hallway. And at the time, I'm watching a Burr, a Marin, an Ali Wong, a Sebastian Maniscalco. I'm watching basically the AC/DC of comedy, you know, the biggest stars. And you're right next to them. There's no like back up over here. There's no backstage. You're in the hallway. And I had the opportunity to watch these guys every night. I was always blown away. Other comedians weren't in there watching these guys just throw down a masterclass and just be able to watch them every night and no one bothering me. That is the last of probably the old school, because once the backstage starts happening with bands and you can't really, you know, ever see them anywhere, maybe like at a grocery store by luck or something. The kind of mingling with superstars went away. Of course, after Lennon, you know, gets shot and all that, it starts to get crazy, you know? So I understand it, but comedy, man, it's wild. You could be right in there with the biggest.
That's a wonderful thing, because proximity, it does create like knowledge. You know, it's like watching, the closer you watch to magic, the more you learn. Like, you know, if you go to the Magic Castle and they do a magic trick like 2 inches from your face, it's very intoxicating and it makes you want to learn more rather than just going and seeing giant diamond vision screens and you're watching it from across the county and you're going, well, that's unattainable. That doesn't even make, I don't even, it's so impersonal. And the nature of, like you said, just sitting with your elbow right against a hero and watching him react teaches you, you learn a lot. The tactile experience is critical.
Once you're into Ringo and Charlie Watts, obviously you get into the Heartbreakers, they get created in LA and you start playing. Who do you start to get into also? Like, are you seeing other drummers like, wow, this is crazy? And of course, Bonzo being my favorite of all time. But, you know, and double bass starts to come around and all this different stuff. Who else was blowing you away?
I was blown away by bands. It was, I know this is going to sound probably ridiculous. I wasn't a drummer. I was the drummer in the Heartbreakers. I never wanted to be a drummer. I wanted to be in that band. And so everything was, all my heroes were guys that could figure out how to be in bands, or they were amazing session guys like Jim Keltner.
Oh,
he probably had a big effect on me as like a, you know, like, wow, that's a guy who just manages to understand music and always plays the right thing. He just always pulls the right gun and nails it. And but my mostly for me, music was very personal, and my friends became my favorite musicians. You know, if I liked a guy, he was my favorite. And I still to this day have amazingly good friends that play music, and people that befriended me, I started to understand their music more. Like even sometimes there were people I'd go like, why? I wasn't really into that. But then once I met them, I'd go, holy shit, that's really good. They have a craft that I don't have. And so I wasn't really influenced by a lot of the stick twirling and all of that. I was excited by it. I'd be like, oh, hell, that's really cool. But I loved guys that played in their band. And I just thought that's the coolest you can be.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim Keltner is mind boggling to me, especially like his snare sound. It always had that perfect 70s kind of dead snare. You know, it was perfect. I love that sound. Like, Long Run snare to me. The Long Run snare is the ultimate 70s snare to me.
That's a tough one. And Don Henley, if he wasn't such an amazing songwriter, record producer, and singer, he'd only be known as the guy who played on all the Eagles hit records. He'd only be known as that drummer. You know, like, I mean, you have to... he's been so overlooked as a influential drummer. I think it's hysterical to me. Like, you know, and even when you're around him, he doesn't refer to his drumming at all. It's like, you know, occasionally you kind of have to hit him in the shoulder and go, dude, that's pretty cool. You know? So yeah, but those are the kind of guys I go like, holy shit, them's the big boys. You know?
Yeah. 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 I mean, that drumming on In the City, oh man, it's so cool.
Well, all those records. I mean, even like Lion Eyes, you would take that for granted, that you could just sit there and play time and play acrostic like that. You try it. You know, get on a balance beam that's this wide for 4.5 minutes. Good luck. See you.
Yeah,
you're not gonna make it. And that's focus and that's discipline, and that's where drummers sort of get a bad rap. But the best drummers to me have this tremendous tolerance for repetition and discipline, and it's a bitch. I mean, and I've gotten better since I've been out of the band, because I've been working with better, you know, I've been working with a lot of great drummers from the other side of the glass. So I've seen the craft from both sides now. And if I could go back and do some things again, it's probably a good thing I can't, because I would never do what I did, you know?
Well, that's what I love, when you are organically new in something, you're playing what the instincts and survival.
Yeah.
And then later I find if you go back, like you'll see a guy, well, we're going to remix and I'm going to play some different stuff on here. And then you're like, ah, no, man, because you overthought it. You're like, now I'm better. And it's like, nah, that's not better. Maybe it's different.
Being puerile and being a punk, it has its advantages at a certain time in your life.
Yeah, totally. Let me ask you, you had a hand in that Eagles 99 When Hell Freezes Over tour. Is that right? Like, what was your part in that?
I was invited by Don, who had been really in the 80s when Don was working on his solo records. Danny Korchmeyer and Don invited me to come hang out, basically. Like, and they were both friends, and they still are. And I served a kind of an apprenticeship in the studio. They allowed me to be there and audit the process of how they work and how they write and produce and create. And that led to so many collaborations with them. And it led to me learning the craft of producing and writing, and opened so many doors. So I think that really, the work I've been able to do with the Eagles was, or that the one song, essentially, Don, I had just wrapped up my time with Tom and the guys. And I was just hanging out at this very house, and the phone rang, and Don was like, "What are you doing?" Because that's, he'd obviously heard, you know, that I was no longer in the band, but that's just, he's a cool guy. He doesn't, you know, like, move. It was more like, "What are you up to?" And I was like, "Not much." He goes, "Well, get your ass on a plane, bring your studio, come out to California, and let's get to work." He goes, I'm putting the Eagles back together, and you know, take a shot at getting a song with us." You know, wow. And it was like, I mean, you can't ask for a better big brother, you know? So he's been that for me for decades now. He's been the guy going like, "Why don't you do it?" And I'm like, "Well, can I do that?" And he goes, "Why don't you find out?" You know, so he's been a really, I can't say enough cool things. He's a badass, and he's taught me a lot.
Oh my God. I mean, his soul, that end of, what is it? The End of Innocence record. It is. I mean, there's that one song on there. I was going through like a breakup at the time. You know, I got the call today. Didn't want to hear, you know, End of the Innocence, the actual song. It is so potent to me, you know, and Boys of Summer, just those, you know, that's another thing that the Heartbreakers had. It really felt California, you know, and I love California stuff. Not so much the Beach Boys, poppy stuff, but the stuff that really captures California.
You're referring, I think, to Heart of the Matter.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah, yeah. And it's on the End of the Innocence record. But that song is so great.
It's beautiful. I play drums on that.
Oh, my God. That's like one of my favorite tunes ever from him.
Yeah. Yeah, Don orchestrated that drum part and gave me a shot at playing that and walked me right through it. You know, that's, but yeah, I mean, that was that record that's when they were pretty much said like, "Lynch, you can audit, you can hang out." And there were days I was just thrilled to be in the room and watching so many good things happening. I was learning, man, it was just coming at me like a fire hose of information, you know, and that served me well. All the rooms I've been in, even at the time when they were uncomfortable with certain producers, I always learned something, you know, I always learned something. And that's a really cool thing. Continuing education is, I love that. I love when I'm slightly uncomfortable, it usually means I'm about to learn something, you know, don't rebel. Don't say it sucks. Just open your mind and try to absorb. There's a lot to learn, and you'll never learn at all.
No. Yeah. And also you're living if you're learning. I think once you stop learning, you just become that, you're done.
I love the education of that music's giving me. And it as sad as this may sound, it also doubles as my social life. You know, it's like all my friends generally do this and I get to work with them and that's it. You know, it's pretty much starts friends first. And let's see where the music takes us, you know?
You worked with some amazing producers in your career. Of course, one of the greats, Jimmy Iovine. You had to have just learned so much from that guy. Still to this day, it's probably unraveling in your head, you know, from Damn the Torpedoes and that whole sessions.
Jimmy Iovine is a, first and foremost, is a song guy.
Right.
He wants... And that's what you learn from a guy like that. Don't even bother to even show up unless you've got good songs. Like, he's got that priority dialed in. And that's what I saw, or that, you know, that's what I learned from those years. And then he also had a brilliant engineer in Shelly Akis. He was the guy who basically organized the sonic quality of those records. So Jimmy is an executive of the highest order, and he prioritizes. And sometimes it can be brutal because you're not part of that priority. You know, you're not needed in this conversation. But in retrospect now, I have tremendous respect, and I understand what a guy like that does, what Jimmy Iovine does. I get it, you know?
Do you feel... that certain producers, because I've worked with certain producers and they could work you the wrong way to where it starts to fuck with your confidence. Like, I was a singer. So you work with one producer, and they're a stickler on these notes, like flat, sharp. And you're going like, wait a minute. You know, you're pulling the headphone off. You got one headphone. You're in the room. You're like, what is going on? Then you work with another producer, and they're like, God damn, you're singing key like perfect. What is it? You know what I mean? Do you think that can happen? I've seen it with drummers where all of a sudden they just get red light fever. They're slowing down. They lose everything.
You just said it perfectly. I mean, part of the job to me of being a good producer, but this is, look, there's so many different ways to skin a cat. To me, a good producer makes the artists and the musicians want to do their best. You know, they want to do this. Other producers, it's more of a punishment. It's more like, if you don't do this, you will be scolded. And that's a very, and look, it's probably all in the way we were raised. I don't know. I mean, this, you could spend a fortune in therapy trying to understand all of this. But to me, you know, from my perspective as a producer, I already know usually that if it's a younger band, they're already intimidated. This is already a terribly intimidating process to figure out how to get this, what's in your head, to come out of the speakers. That's, wow, there's a Grand Canyon between what you're hearing here and what you're hearing there. Now, the mature guys that have been doing this their whole lives, they don't need me to be a cheerleader. It's almost pedantic if I do that. They're almost looking at me going like, oh, put a sock in it, man. You know, But it's because they know, you know, those guys are already hard on themselves.
Yeah.
My job is probably just to make them less hard on themselves. But with younger bands, I think that the way to get the best from a young band is to be encouraging and to welcome them into the process. Like, I always liked it when I was struggling, if a guy like Denny Cordell would say, why don't we lay a couple down and come in and listen with me? And then we'd make eye contact when something good or bad happened. So we would get an awareness together. He was involving me rather than just saying from a talk back going like, that one didn't have it. You know, like, that's a million miles away. That sucked.
And the people talking in the control room, you know, and then eventually he comes over and goes, maybe try it again. And then you go, oh, what the fuck?
Yeah, but the guys that will say, come in and listen and learn. That's because really nothing, if you didn't grow up as a studio musician, it's a very different world. You know, being recording is so different than singing live or playing live. But once you get the hours in, it does become sort of natural. It becomes like more like walking it's like the first time you walk, you're bouncing into walls and you look like an idiot, but after a while you just get up and go, you know?
Yeah. I mean, once you get used to them soloing up something, especially a vocal, they go, this sounds a little pitchy. Let's give this listen. They solo it up and you go, or what's going on with your tempo here? Let's listen to this here, the kit, you know?
Well, thank God they weren't there when they made all my favorite records.
Yeah, I know, right? Because I love the push and pull of tempos. I love the, you know, later it became metronomes and it became like drum machines and it must be this. And I'm not down with that. Now, if it's an obvious slowdown where you go like, dude, you something happened there. But if it's a feel, a push and pull, that's where I love drumming.
Well, it's fun to work without a net. It's but that requires the whole band are massaging the same side of beef at the same time, you know, like we're all working on it. But it's interesting though, but I'm glad, like I listen to records now, like old records, and man, sometimes it is pitchy. Thank God it's pitchy. I mean, thank God they didn't auto-tune Mick Jagger.
Oh my God.
You know, thank God you didn't, you know, or even The Who, like sometimes there's some grace in the struggle and the fight. You know, you hear him going for it, like not just nailing it. You hear him, and it's like, that to me is the flying by the seat of your pants. That's what I miss about records today. You don't hear the bond. You don't hear the fight. You know, you don't hear it.
Yeah, that's the sadness of stems, I call it.
Well, that's interesting. Well, everybody, I mean, I've worked with young bands now where, like, literally the drummer comes in, plays it twice and looks at me and goes, "You got enough to work with?" Basically wants me to spend the next 2 days editing this into a drum track. And I'm like, "Dude, you don't have enough money to pay me to edit. You've got enough money to let me stand here and watch you work." You know what I mean? Like, but you know, you ain't got a budget that says, like, I'm going to sit here and listen to your shit and try to turn it into like real shoe leather. Forget it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you about a couple things. Recently, one of my best friends is Jacob Dylan. That's not a name drop. I'm just bringing it up because he recently did Long After Dark from top to bottom in LA. And yeah, it was fucking a magic night, man. He played the Wallflowers hits, and then they took a quick break, and then he played Long After Dark from top to bottom. And to hear that record after all these years live from a band playing it, it was incredible to hear some of the deep tracks, you know, that you forget about, just really kabonked me, you know? And, you know, it was awesome to hear, you know?
Jacob Dylan's really good. And I never, when we were on the road with his pop, he was around, but I never connected to him. And I regret that, because it's like, you know, I've always wanted to, you know, grab him by the shoulders and go, "Dude, you're a soul man," you know? And I just think he's pretty damn cool, you know?
Well, it was funny. What he said on stage was, he's like, "Look, I was lucky enough to spend a summer out on tour with my dad. And the opener, not necessarily the opener, but the band was the Heartbreakers." And, you know, he goes, "I was more blown away by the Heartbreakers. That's what drew him in. Like, oh my God, listen to this band," you know?
Well, he put together a good band too, you know?
Oh yeah.
That's another guy. Please pass on my warmth and respect to that guy. You know? Yeah. That's cool. It's really nice to hear.
Let me ask you on, is this Simmons drums on Don't Come Around Here No More? Or is that just programmed?
That's, I think the beat is it's an Oberheim drum machine.
Oh yeah.
With a delay. And so if you, what you're hearing is a simple, simple program, but the delay creates the width of that pattern. But that's Dave Stewart.
I got ya. Did you ever get into Simmons drums?
No, I did not.
I love how you made me have to think, like, oh, absolutely not.
No, I was just trying to imagine. I think I had a thing called a snare briefly, like this electronic thing. We made a joke out of it on a couple records. It's on the beginning, Making Noise or something. But no, it did right past me.
What is your drums of choice?
Today I'm using do you know who Greg Bissonette is?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, he's a dear friend. And he had a drum kit made for me by a company called Dixon, and he designed it and built it to his specifications for me about 4 years ago during COVID. I used to play Tama drums for years. They were really good. Then I ended up, when the band was over, I kind of had to let all that go and ended up with my old Ludwig stash. You know, I kept all my old Ludwig drums, and then I was complaining about that they weren't quite doing what I wanted. And Biss was like, "Well, let him build you a kit. Let me design your drum set." Well, damn if he didn't have a kit sent to me that I'm never, you know, that'll be the last drum set I need. It's so good. And, but yeah, that great drum company, and it's pretty hard to beat Greg Bissonette designing you a drum set. You know, it's like, yep, that works. You know?
Are they built in California or?
I don't think so. I think, they're all maple. The kit is all, it looks like a Bonzo kit, like an old blonde Bonzo kit, but they're very thin shelled. Their tolerances are perfection, and there's no internal mufflers. The you know, this is all technical crap, but where the head seats is a kind of a radical, they're very live and lively and they tune. It's just, they're just a lot of fun. They're just, and they're cool looking. So I'm happy.
Yeah, that's great. I think I saw your last gig with the Heartbreakers at the Bridge Benefit.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I blocked all that out.
Walk me through that, because that was your last gig, right?
Probably. I mean, I think after that, I went into the studio and cut a, like Mary Jane's Last Dance, and we probably got together. But yeah, I think in terms of performing, probably. I mean, like I said, all that is a blur.
Right.
At that point, because I'm, everybody's unhappy. I'm unhappy with them. They're unhappy with me. People are, there's a lot of things going on in the ether that I'm not understanding. The music is leaving me. I'm leaving it. I'm already, in my mind, moved. I've already moved to Florida and I'm already writing songs. So it was a, it wasn't a comfortable time and it could have been handled better. But in retrospect, I think everybody got what they wanted. I never looked back. You know, I really didn't. It wasn't like, you know, it was just, it was time, you know, like for lack of a better term. If anybody's ever been divorced, it's like it was time. You know what I
mean? Yeah.
But yeah, I don't remember that gig. I really don't. I think I've seen a couple films of it. I think it's acoustic kind of.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Bridge Benefit was a kind of a thing for his kids' school.
Yeah. I honestly, it's like, the last few years, well, not the last few years, the last year or so of the band, I felt like everybody had their foot out the door everywhere else, specifically me. You could feel it a mile away that the minute you walked in the room, you were in the wrong room. As my dad used to say to me, he goes, Stan, the only thing wrong with this picture is you're in it.
I was, I don't know if this came out of your mouth or if it was just clickbait or whatever, but was the main friction at that time, of course, there's built up years of friction, but I had read that it was the Wildflowers record and you were like, hey man, we're a rock band and this is like sad mellow tunes.
No, it's not that. That never happened. I think there was a lot of, there's been words put in everybody's mouths. The truth is it was, I was not asked to be involved and I was busy and I wouldn't have been the right guy anyway. The whole atmosphere had left me. Like I didn't have the right shirt to even be in that room. You know what I mean? I didn't have the clothes. I didn't have the conversation. I was much too animated and I've been a big connoisseur of the joy of life. I don't really know how to get down and dirty in the cracks. And I think some of that music was exploring darker themes and I don't know, man, shit. Now I'm just riffing, but it wasn't for me. Like I said, timing was probably about a day late. Everybody probably should have made that statement about a couple days earlier and before it had to go to it got pretty tense and it didn't need to. It really didn't need to do that. And I think that's maybe a regret I have. And maybe there's a regret on their side of the fence too, that it didn't need to go to that place. It could have just been, look, we're all bros. Flip a coin, pick a day, fuck it, have a beer. It's been a pleasure. Give me a hug. You know, it's, nothing should be that fucking dramatic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, most bands aren't together for 10 years at least. So there's no playbook, you know, you just, and then you throw some drugs in the world and then it starts to get crazy.
Well, money, drugs, all of it. It's a wild ride. And look, there's two words that anybody who's ever been in a band will know immediately. Band shit.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't know from band shit, you don't know shit. So it's like, any band, I don't give a shit if it's the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, your band, my band, any band. It's like, all you got to say is like, what happened? Band shit, man. It's like, you know, got it. Check. Don't need to ask. Only an asshole would ask specifics for what that, like, well, what really happened? It's like, band shit, bro. It's like, got it. Check. You know,
so, also, there isn't one thing that happened. It's what band shit is. It's a fucking rolling ball. And one day the band shit ball just rolls over you.
Well, it also rolls over, as Ben Lyon used to say, if you're not in the room, you're out of luck. Because it's like, you know, whoever, you know, it's just the way the cacophony of chaos and everybody's trying to cope with it and understand what fame and money, and you're processing all these things at your own speed. And I'm processing things slower than molasses. And there's Tom processing things at warp speed. You know what I mean? He's just at warp speed because it's coming at him and he's going like, right, I got to deal. And I'm at the bottom of the, you know, I'm out surfing. You know what I mean? Going like, what's the fucking problem? You know? So could there be a miscommunication somewhere in the responsibilities of it all? You know, it's all on his shoulders to write another album. All the thing on my shoulders is, you know, what kind of car do I going to drive next? You know, I don't know what the fuck my problems were. They weren't even, you know, what am I going to have? What sushi bar is cool? I mean, I don't know. I was a classic prototypical rock drummer for a lot of that time. And that served the band well for a while. They needed, a needed strong word. I was the right guy at the right time. And like I said, what they needed later certainly wasn't that guy. And I didn't need that guy anymore after a while either.
Yeah. So, I had opened for Petty on the Echo tour, and it was an interesting record, and it's very dark times for the band, but it was really obvious that Howie was probably not going to make it.
Wow.
You know, from what I saw, he was nodding off, you know, up there on stage. And it was brutal because he was one of my favorite players. I mean, ever, you know, did when you heard that he passed, were you surprised or did you have no idea what was going on in that camp?
I was out of the loop. I saw him at the Hall of Fame and it frightened me because the last time I had spent time with Howie, he could beat me at arm wrestling. And he was a badass. And he was tough. You know, kid from Milwaukee. He was like, you know, he's a beautiful man, soulful, talented. And I didn't, you know, I lost track of all of those guys after my tenure. I never put my nose under their tent. We didn't really even talk. I lost interest. I lost interest. And so when invited to join them at the Hall of Fame, I walked into rehearsal and I remember seeing Howie for the first time in what it had been probably, I don't know, eight, nine years, maybe. I don't know. I've got the timeline, you know, 94 to 2002 was probably the, so I walked in and I remember like, wow, this beautiful body guy was tiny. He was so tiny and he was being helped. And I do remember saying to the guys individually, like, what the hell's going on? Like, cause I was, and then it was almost like, you have no idea what we've been through. And I'm like, okay, you're right. I don't have the right to just walk in and start passing judgment and telling everybody what they should do. I'm not in. And then it turned out I learned more over time that had been a spiral. And, but yeah, I was extremely angry, that had quote been allowed to happen. This is my mind, how I'm seeing it. Like, how could you let that happen to this soulful guy that you love. That was me. And after the Hall of Fame, I did call Howie because I had heard he had been let go. And that freaked me out even further. Like, I was like, oh, shit. But I didn't, you know, my kingdom was of all of what I did not know could have filled the Goodyear blimp. What I didn't know would fill a matchbox. So I remember calling him and I said, hey, I'm concerned. I'm scared. You know, I'm scared because of what I'm seeing. And he was very defensive. And I believe that his demons were in charge at that point. We weren't really talking. He was saying, but he was waiting for me to get off the phone. And I know that now, having dealt with people with dependency issues, and that they'll indulge you to a point, but they're not interested in hearing. But I told him I loved him. And I told him, I remember saying, like, I wish you'd come down to Florida. Let me take care of you. You know, I did, you know, I said, I got room at the inn, you know, I'd love, you know. And I much remember saying, join the small crowd of people that used to play with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You're in a very elite club. And, you know, I tried to get it, but even that didn't go. It wasn't funny, you know. To say I love Howie Epstein and his family and his brother, Craig, to this day, there, you know, man, you know, what can you say about a guy? You know, I went around the world with him, made me laugh my ass off. His first gig was the fucking US Festival.
Oh, man.
He walked out on stage. I mean, I think I got this right. You know, I'm like, you know, we walk out and there's, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, like, it's like the biggest gig in the world. And Howie, you know, I'm going like, I'm giving Howie shit. Of course, I'm going like, hey, hope you're not nervous. You know, I'm winding him up. And he's like, we walk out. And after the first song at the US Festival, Howie walks over to the drum riser. He goes, you call that drumming?
Oh. Oh, my God. I love that US Festival story because I'm obsessed with the US Festival. I went and, you know, Steve Wozniak and that location and just that insanity of that thing. And I feel like those two US Festivals do not get enough glory. It's like Woodstock to me. And then the US Festival, that's really the gap.
It was the huge 80s excess. You know, you're taking helicopters and you're getting in elevators that go up sixth floor to get on stage. You know what I mean? It was like, okay, this is pretty big, but I loved the takeaway from that was that's how cool Howie Epstein is under fire. I mean, probably did like a couple of days of rehearsal. Cause I remember we would ask him like, do you need to go through do you know Refugee? And he would just be like, yeah, I know Refugee. It would be more like, you want me to sing?
Yeah. God, he could sing, huh? Oh, my God.
He took the load right off me, baby, just to paraphrase the weight. It was like, you know, because a couple of times he'd look, you know, remember, before we even were playing, I would say, you know, like, if we might do this, a song from the old days. And he goes, you want me to sing harmony? I'm like, you actually know it? He goes, oh, yeah, I know your shit. You know, it's like, so, but I mean, how he could give and take it. He was so much fun, man. No, he wore his life like a pair of jeans that fit. You know what I mean? It's like you'd walk on stage with Howie Epstein and you'd look over and he was always had a cigarette and he would somehow manage to put the cigarette out at the exact second to get his hand on the bass and get to the microphone. It was so like watching Howie was part of my show. You know what I mean? So, and the same with Ben and Mike and Tom, all of those guys. It was like, I had the best seat in the house to watch what I considered one of the coolest rock bands in the world. And I saw it all in real time. It was like, this is awesome. You know?
So great, man. I saw Tom's last gig at the Hollywood Bowl, which at the time we didn't know it was the last gig. Also an interesting fact, Eddie Van Halen's last gig ever, Hollywood Bowl. So it's wild to think about. But of course, you know, we know what happens. He passes away. And, you know, who calls you? Mike Campbell?
Oh, man, my phone lit up. Like I said, I don't text, but I saw probably 50 texts. Is it true? I'm sorry. You know, all, and I live out in the woods. I was in a very, my crib is in a rural area outside of town. You know, it's a tree farm. I'm like out in the middle of nowhere, sitting on a tractor, you know, having like probably, I don't know what I was doing, planting blueberries for all I know. And my phone is just going, brr, brr, it's just blowing up. And I'm looking at it going, what the fuck does this all mean? And then I think it was Benmont, of course, you know, it would be. And I saw Ben. And so I picked up the phone and he goes, something like he assumed I knew everything and went right to where he was. And, you know, he was in the hospital and what's happening. And I was, you know, I'm way late catching up. You know what I mean? I'm already way behind the curve. And I think one of the dumber things I said was, is there a chance he'll be okay?
Whoa. Yeah, you're just in shock, right?
Well, I literally was like, someone's in the hospital. Well, my first, you know, because I'd been going through with my parents at the time. Well, is he going to be okay? And Ben was like, sort of almost hung up, you know, because he was like, you're not getting it. And yeah. Of course I wasn't getting it because I didn't know what the fuck was going on. And then I went into my house and the TV was on and it was like, it was news. It was new, like every channel, like I'm watching the news and it unfolded to me in really odd, in an odd way. It was like, I couldn't. And plus I hadn't been in the band in so long that I wasn't even on that planet. I wasn't on Heartbreaker planet. I was on another planet. And so like being, and they're showing clips and like, I'm even in some of the clips and it's like, what the fuck? It was really surreal day. I'm probably still processing it. I still have dreams where I'm having conversations with Tom over dinner and we're working things out and we're laughing. And you know, it's a very, very complicated experience to describe to somebody how important these people are or were to me and creating my entire life. I owe them everything. You know, I owe, you know, without those guys, shit, I'd probably be saying, please drive through. Would you like fries? You know, I don't know what I'd be doing without those guys. So when you lose two out of, you know, you lose two, that's a lot of brothers, man. You know, it's sobering, you know, like, I mean, there's certain lines in culture that I don't cross drug wise or I never could, but I can see misadventure as a terrible way to go. I would not advocate. You know, it's deeply disturbing, obviously, as I'm trying to process it as I'm talking to you. It's like, I can't make sense out of it. It's like, why the fuck aren't those guys here? You know, that's the thought that goes through my mind. Fuck, I want to talk to them.
Yeah. 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 It's, I mean, unfortunately, it's a rock and roll is a brutal game, you know. You playing, sitting in with the Dirty Knobs and me seeing Jacob do, you know, the full record and everything. You know, I sat in that room, this theater, and I thought to myself, you know, an incredible tour, a tribute to Tom would be Heartbreakers with Jacob. It would be this kind of full circle, beautiful thing and go out and tour with him fronting it, you know? And I was thinking about that for weeks. Like, that would be the man. I mean, we're not going to replace Tom, but just here's a celebration, a summer celebration with the Heartbreakers Jacob Dylan singing it.
I mean, that's really not up to me.
Oh, I hear you. I'm just saying, man, would it be beautiful? You know what I'm saying?
I would love to play with those original guys. I wouldn't care if we just booked a room at SIR for a night just to go make noise. I don't really know about tributing and I don't even understand how to put that together, but emotionally, but to make that noise with those guys, that's a mother church for me. And I love them all. You know, Ron's great. You know, Mike Campbell's great. Ben Montench is great. I can still throw wood around. It's like, so I don't know I have no thought about what it would be or could grow up to become. But like I said, if somebody would book a living room and let us go in and play covers, I'd be all over it, you know? So just to hear that noise while I still can, because one day it's going to be gone and I'm, you know, and I know it more than they know that, you know, because I know when it was gone, it was gone. I don't know that they fully processed what I've been able to process, you know, like, and I think that it would be a missed opportunity for us not to all get in a room and make noise. I think that would be a shame. Even if it sucked, it would still be funny.
Yeah. I believe that too. I believe it too, man. Just to get.
But Jacob, I mean, like, I don't know him, but he obviously.
Oh, he'd kill it. He'd kill it. Oh, and the people would be fired up. Just the, you know, because it would be like celebration and it's organic. It's not like, he was there, you know, on that Dylan Petty tour. And then he loves Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And then just you back in there, I think it would just be, I mean, it would tear me up, man. It would tear me up.
It's a very romantic notion.
Absolutely. I like to throw stuff out there though. You know,
you obviously are a romantic. That's love.
Let's talk Stereo Wars before we get out of here.
Speaker Wars?
What? Oh, Speaker Wars. Yeah. You know what? I was calling it. No. I was calling it Stereo Wars because, you know, when you have like a turntable and Macintosh and then somebody else is like battling you like, no, this is the fidelity over here. So when I saw Speaker Wars, to me, it was similar to what I always say to people like, oh, some more Stereo Wars, you know?
What do you want to know? I'll tell you anything.
So you got, when does it come out? I heard the single.
I think in May. I think they're going to do, the label's going to release two more videos. And I think in May, they're going to release vinyl and a CD.
So you got a video out right now. You Make Every Lie Come True. It's on Frontiers Music. And so what, you were going to produce this guy, John Christopher Davis, and then you got in there and was like, fuck it, let's do a band?
John's like a little brother to me. And we got together in Nashville we were on separate rosters as staff writers. And John, I think we got put together in a blind date, which is how they do it there. And you usually kind of walk in going like, oh, I don't know. Well, this guy walks in and he's on fire and I love him. And he's got all the same references that I have musically. He loves Merle and he loves all that cool shit that I love. Loves Steppenwolf. He loves all this gritty, wonderful crap that I just eat up. And I'm kind of like amazed because he's younger. He's more fighting in your weight class, you know? So I was stunned that he actually had these touch tones. We wrote, I didn't think, and then they asked me to produce him and we went into the first production meeting and they pitched us these five horrible songs. I mean, just like, and I was stunned because I'm like, John had just played me a dozen good songs. And I, without, you know, Tourette's, I went like, well, why would we cut this shit when this guy's got good songs? And I realized, like in Nashville, you don't say that, you know, that's not how it works. Well, we got fired, both of us, like that minute. We didn't really know it, but they just said like, well, we'll be talking to you later. Well, we're walking across the parking lot and I'm thinking, well, I guess I just fucked that up. And John, I'm thinking, and I hear, hey, Lynch. And John, I'm going like, this is where I get my, once again, I get, you know, one more black eye. And John comes running at me and I'm thinking, oh Christ, here it comes. And he gives me this big hug and he goes, bro, he goes, man, nobody's ever spoken up for me, man. You defended me, man. Cool. And I'm thinking, well, at least he's got soul. He went out with, you know, with his finest flag. I didn't think much about it. And then about 2 weeks later, I'm back home in Florida. He goes, what are you doing? He goes, I want to come down and let's do some more writing. So he kept the relationship going. And I thought I was just going to be writing stuff for his record, you know, because I like to write and he likes to sing. And then during COVID, when we all were like, you know, burning our groceries and setting fire to our clothes and not, you know, walking outside with a bubble on our head. And, you know, we all made the decision during COVID, well, I'm either going to just dry up and blow my brains out, or am I going to get to work? Well, work during COVID became file sharing. You know, if you owned a studio, and I do, you learn to make records remotely. It's not my favorite way to do it, but I learned a lot about that from Jeff Lynn because he's very one at a time. So it wasn't a foreign thing for me to consider. And so John and I basically built the bulk of that record during COVID. And then he just kept bothering me, going like, well, when you don't have hair on your ass, if you don't get behind a kit and come play. And I'm like, ah. And so finally I just went, well, let me come out to Texas, where he kind of had most of the band. And we played and I figured, well, fuck it. Why not? Let's have some fun. You know, I have very managed expectations. I don't delude myself, but I would just love to be able to make more. We've got another record that I think is better already. And we've got a band that's really good that can play. And I would love it if we could get out and get to work. That'd be fun.
Oh man. It's just, anytime I get to see you play or hear you play, it is a gift, man. You know, you to me are one of the greatest rock and roll drummers as far as I would say ultimate team player. You're not back there trying to pop out, you know, you're playing to the song and you're playing super grooves that just have knocked me out since 1976 when I heard as a kid the first record. So I can't thank you enough for still playing, man, still alive and still being creative and pretty damn positive. It's great to, great news that this is coming out, you know?
Well, thank you. I mean, look, I've been really lucky. This is all I've ever had to do since I was 14 years old. You know what I mean? This is it. So with your help and with your listeners, check it out. You know, I mean, man, if you like it, we'd love to play for y'all. And it's, like I said, I'm under no delusions of grandeur. I love getting together with guys. Being in a band is really fun. It's frustrating because you don't always get your way, but that's always cool too. It's like a good meeting. Nobody wins in a good meeting. Everybody kind of walks out of there going, what the shit happened? And it's like, I love that about being in a band. It's funny. These guys they're Texas. They're rowdy and they're like, it's like I've known them my whole lives. I've known them several years now, but it's fun. And that's really what I want to focus on between now and I want to run out the clock with as much fun as possible.
I'm the same way, man. I'm the same way. I started comedy late because I was like, yeah, fuck it. I'm going to try something different. You know,
congratulations. Cause really it's only your life we're talking about.
That's it. Like, what are you going to do, man?
I know, but it's like, Jesus Christ. It's, you know, what do you, whose permission do you got to ask to have a laugh, you know, ask yourself, you know, it's like, and we, you know, when you're done whipping your own ass, wake up and go, shit, let's get some yucks. And, but I really appreciate your time today. And I appreciate you turning the band on to people. It means the world to me. And,
it was an honor to talk to you, man. I'm telling you big time. You can go listen to my record, Dean Del Rey, Lone Mountain Serenade, and you can hear the full on Petty vibe, not just in, like, you know, of course I'm not that level, but you strive to have your players sound like the Heartbreakers, and you strive to have your songs, you know, move people like the Heartbreakers. So that, you know, that is a, you know, a thank you to you and all of the band, you know?
Well, the other side of that conversation goes something like this. It's a really touching. And at the same time, I would always encourage anybody who picks up an instrument, sound exactly like you.
Yeah.
You know, like, sign your work, whatever you do. I mean, I'm not saying it's fun to look. I try to emulate other people and still fuck it up, but it's like, but if you sign your work and it's you, then you've done your job, man. That's the coolest thing. There's only one of you, you know? And so you may as well go out screaming your song, you know?
Well, there's nothing better than somebody saying, you know, especially like in comedy now, where somebody will say like, oh, that's such a Dean Del Rey thing. You know, I love that. It's like, all right. Signature.
You bet it is. Like you said, you signed your work. Matisse.
Yeah.
Picasso. It's like, you know, that's what you want to be in life, is a cubist version of yourself. You know, just bear down on it.
Thank you for doing the show. And hopefully I'll see you in person one day. Maybe I'm out there in Florida doing comedy, or you're playing a gig here in LA, and I will come down and shake your hand.
I would love that. And it's like, hey, look, if you feel like doing this again sometime, just make it happen.
Oh my God. I would do a part two with you anytime, man. Anytime.
That's your call.
Okay. I'm on it. I'll set it up. Thank you. Candles lit, my man.
All right, man. Later on.
Later.